Okay, we're back. And now I'm back on the slide that I thought I had, that I didn't have, because I loaded up a wrong version, an older version. Okay, so Epictetus says, if this is the case, practice from the start to say to every harsh impression to your brain, you're just an impression. You're not really at all the thing you appear to be. You're not the real thing. You're just the thing my brain is telling me. Then examine it and test it by these rules that you have, firstly and chiefly by this, whether the impression has to do with the things that are up to us in our control or those that are not. If it has to do with the things that are not up to us in our control, be ready to say to it, it's nothing to me. Right? What's it to me if it's not within my control? So, this is the better diagram. Now, this means that everything we experience and see has to pass through our own brain. This actually gives us hope, because we're going to see and understand, if I can change the way I see something, perceive something, interpret something, if I can see it and understand it differently, assign a different meaning to it, see it, perceive it from a different angle, interpret it, understand it differently, then I can change the emotion that I will actually experience. If I work with my filter, it will affect my subjective experience. But so many people will naturally say, but I feel what I feel. As if that justifies what they're about to do. As if it is the ultimate bottom line justification for the test of reality. I feel what I feel. As if one then cannot argue with what they feel. I'm not questioning the reality of the emotion a person is experiencing. I'm never questioning what's real to that person. I'm not questioning the authenticity of the emotion and the subjective experience they're having. I am inviting them to question the story, the assigned meaning in their brain that is producing the emotion. They think those two are exactly the same. Ah, I just said a tricky statement. So, if we can work with the B part, interpretation, perception, our glasses, the meaning our brain is assigning to it, the story we are constructing, how my brain makes sense of it, if we can change that, which it is changeable, the story we tell ourselves, the story our brain constructed, how I see something, we can actually influence and change our emotions and our subjective experience. So, I'm going to re-ask the question.
So, are you going to lie to your emotions?
I'm going to lie to my emotions? No, your emotions are authentic. What's producing them? I'm questioning it. People have panic attacks all the time. Do you know where they go? To the hospital? To the emergency room? Because they believe they're having a heart attack. I assure you, they are not having a heart attack. Their emotions are authentic. They think they're dying. What's producing the emotions, the brain's construction, is highly questionable. Did that make sense? The emotions are real. I assure you, all the doctors in the emergency room after doing an EKG say there's nothing wrong with your body. Nothing. You're not having a heart attack. So the brain is reading the body's signals. It actually thinks it's dying, which we'll see later, then produces more emotions to confirm they're dying. It's a feedback loop. But the problem was the brain was misattributing, misassigning the meaning. But the body felt the authentic meaning. Do you see that? This is why I'm not questioning the reality of one's emotions. I'm actually questioning the foundation that is producing the authentic emotions. So now I'm going to re-ask the question. Can you trust your emotions? 100% yes. Because it will match what your brain, the meaning your brain is assigning to the event. I didn't say the meaning your brain is assigning is accurate. I didn't say it accurately matches reality. I am telling you the meaning our brain comes up with will exactly produce the one-to-one correspondence to the emotion we are feeling. I did not say the meaning your brain came up with is an accurate representation of reality. Do you see that? But the emotion we feel will exactly match the story our brain came up with. It will exactly match. They have to. Because our brain is surveying the context, picking up the signals, going down, you'll see in a minute, selecting a category that's been pre-learned, assigns a label to it. Now you're in a full-blown subjective emotional state. There's only one problem. The subjective experience is real. The foundation that's producing it is in suspect. The meaning and interpretation may not be accurate. Does that make sense? Do you know when policemen are trained to spot danger and they come up on a suspect, the suspect reaches for his wallet and somebody yells, he's got a gun, and boom, boom, boom. Their brain most likely saw a gun. Think it was a gun. Does that make sense? But the brain misattributed, misperceived, as we're going to see, and now we have a person who is severely injured or deceased, and there is no gun. But the brain was predicting a gun, saw a gun. There was no gun. Doesn't exist. Except in the person's brain, it existed. So we have to train police officers to be careful of the quickness of the brain and what it's doing. So the brain constructs, then it simulates. The brain takes in data from your body, if it's feeling it. Through our senses, we see something, we hear something, sensations are experienced, waves, neurological sensations. The brain then seeks to make sense of this data by drawing upon a past previous data bank of learned experiences, categories, to give a possible meaning to the present. The brain selects a prior learned category and links it to the present experience to make sense, to understand, interpret, and give it meaning. So if a person has been hurt in the past, and there are sensitive markers on their interpretation filter, what are they prone to see? Some danger. Their brain is protecting them, and through this filter it says, well, we have some sensitive learned markers in your past. Remember these markers? And these markers are like a magnet, and the data is like metal shavings. And when they come through, the magnet collects them, and it says, you know what this is. You're about to get hurt. And the quickness, what I want you to see, the brain is firing so fast, what you and I have learned is that the brain is being triggered. It's reacting. It's not true. We have excellent brain science that says our brain is not simply being triggered, it's like a Google search engine. You type in 5 words into the Google search bar, what happens? It populates it, and it fills in where it predicts you're going. Right? How did it know? Through the tens of millions of people who have typed that same sentence, it's learned to quickly advance and save you time. Got it? That's what your brain is doing.
What about a baby that has never heard a noise before but associates the noise with danger?
I don't know that the baby is associated with danger, but a good question to be answered. Something's happening, even if it's a startle effect. So there may be a pre-wiring, even to the sensation of falling, that is pre-wired into us, pre-learned.
An instinct?
Fair enough.
Okay.
Fair enough. I like that word. An instinct. Something's pre-wired. But imagine all the experiences that we have collected in life. Imagine some of the sensitive markers on our filter. So picture your brain, and I love libraries, like walking down a wonderful floor with stacks and stacks of books. Your brain is going down that stack, and it's pulling out a certain book, a pre-learned concept, to interpret the present. Make sense? There's only one problem. A brain doesn't get it correct all the time. It's going to its nearest learned concept to interpret the present. Now, what does your brain see when it looks at this? What does it see?
Triangles.
There, I like that. A Jewish star. Pac-Man. But notice what your brain is doing. It's filling in the blanks to its nearest learned concept. It sees because it's constructing and simulating to make sense of the data. All right? So, this is good and bad because what we see, hear, touch, taste, smell, and feel are simulations of the world in front of us. Simulations are our brain's best guess as to what's happening here and now in this situational context. So, like RoboCop, the brain is assessing the situation, its context, and it's assigning its nearest best guess as to what is happening. So every waking moment, our brain is using learned concepts to simulate the external and internal world. Without these, we don't know what's going on. We are experientially blind. We say things like, I don't understand. I don't get it. Because your brain can't find a concept to match what's in front of us. I don't get it. I can't see it. It doesn't make sense. Physical sensations in our bodies have no meaning until the brain assigns a meaning to them. This includes emotions because this is how the brain learns. Our brain constructs the emotions by assigning a meaning and a category. Now, as I said, this is amazing because the brain can misattribute. It's called misattribution. Do you know our body, physical body, and our emotions are uniquely tied together? Did you know that? I don't want to separate the brain and the body. They're all interwoven. Do you know if we push up the muscles of our mouth from a frown into a smile, picture Joker. Sorry. He did win an Academy Award, okay? Once we lift these muscles, it is more difficult to be sad. It's easier to feel the feeling of sadness when there's a frown. If we manipulate the body, you can manipulate some emotions. You know, when we teach people to stand more erect, hold their hand out, make eye contact, shake people's hand, they have the emotion of feeling more confident than if they slump and if their body assumes this position. They feel differently. So body and emotions are tied together. Now here's another interesting fact. If we put a person's body in a state of arousal, physiological heightened state, heart pumping, adrenaline pumping, let's say we put you on a treadmill and really get your heart rate going, blood pumping, do you know the body and the brain and emotions are so directly connected that when the body is in a state of arousal, it's more likely to feel attracted to another human being. Did you hear that? So many of my clients begin having affairs in the workout room. Once a body is already in a state of physiological arousal, the brain is more susceptible to identify an emotion, and it will misattribute the emotion. It will take the arousal and attribute it to the attractiveness of a human being. We have experiment after experiment of this. Men were taken. Half these men walked across a long, wide bridge that had no physical threat. And they took a survey at the other end of the bridge. With the other men, we put them on a high, narrow, frightening bridge extended way up, had them walk across, and then an attractive woman said, "Here, we're taking a survey on your experience of the bridge. Here's my number after you follow up the survey if you have any more questions." Over 80% of the men who walked over the high, threatening bridge called her for a date, whereas nobody on the lower bridge, same woman, called because their body was already in a state of excitement and arousal. Already excited and aroused. Ovid, the Roman poet, wrote a book, and he said, if you want a woman to become attracted to you, take her to the gladiator games. Have her watch people die and get in a state of arousal. If that doesn't work, take a dove and rip off its head in her presence. Valentine's Day is coming up. Just saying. Take a chicken, you know. So, there's an advantage to this and a disadvantage. And by the way, I see people regularly with high anxiety and panic attacks. I had a client today, very first time I've met him. We were nailing it. He understands he's in chronic pain, and his body has learned a neural pathway through anxiety where his physical body now has chronic pain. Because every time he tries to get rid of the anxiety and the pain, everything he does is strengthening the neural pathway. He's done great work. He's seen some experts. And when I said what I'm about to say, he said, "Yes, the two leading experts have told me exactly what you're telling me. That's why I came to see you." I said, "Every time you feel the pain, your body is now trying to, you're trained to reduce the pain emotion, but every time you try to reduce it, it's strengthening it. It's creating a stronger neural pathway for the very emotion you don't want to experience. And your body is in pain, chronic pain." He said, "Yes." I said, "You know, we're going to have to trick your brain. so that when you feel the pain, you must welcome it and not push against it. You must go opposite, and we need to create a new neural pathway, because the old one has you in a feedback loop. He said, that's what the experts are telling me. I said, that's why you've come to see me. But you're going to have to go counterintuitive and fully feel the emotion and the pain and don't push against it. Every time you push against it, you're strengthening it. You got to welcome it, and it will slowly die away and will create a brand new neural pathway. You have to go opposite of what the emotion is telling you. You must welcome it and make it your friend, not your enemy. You see that? Because his body now is in chronic pain, and he has learned and formed a neural pathway because that's what the emotion has taught him. You have to go counterintuitive. So the brain's use of learned concepts enable us to move through life with speed and quickness because it's going like this. It's assigning meaning really quick. But you got to be careful. You got to slow down. It's like a Google search engine. It's helping you be efficient, but I got to be careful. Don't trust it, because the disadvantage is the brain's use of pre-learned concepts means that past experiences now misinform or blur the present, because it's tying into old stories in your brain and it's identifying what's in front of you, interpreting it, making a full-blown subjective arousal state, a powerful emotion. Then we have actions which strengthen that, but it's misinforming us. So speed is good, the Google search engine. Brains are very efficient. Speed is bad because it might be in error. So we have to step back and go, I wonder how I'm seeing it this way. I wonder if my story is accurate. I wonder if I'm predisposed through prior learning experiences that my meter and internal filter is slanted and tilted and bent and has sensitive markers that I should question and ask myself a lot of questions. Am I seeing this accurately? Because once the full-blown emotion hits, we want to act. Did that make sense? We don't question what's producing it. So now we're speeding up, and I would tell all the people that I'm working with, slow down, take a step back. You're feeling a very real emotion. Let's seek to understand it first. Before you act on it, could we ask some questions? So, due to how the brain learns, we're predisposed to be more aware of what we've already seen, what we've already experienced, what we've heard most often. We're predisposed to think what we've already thought, feel what we've already felt, because your brain goes back to it. So the bottom line, sine qua non, of a neural network in the brain is its penchant, its propensity to strengthen the neural patterns directly in proportion to how much we use them. Pay attention to this next sentence. It's how brains work. The more often we think a thought, feel a feeling, imagine a thing, the more probable it is our mind will revisit that same thing. The more we feel a feeling, the more we'll feel the feeling. The more we see something a certain way, the more our brain is predisposed to go back to that understanding. We don't question it, because the brain is moving so quick, like a Google search engine, we just go with it. Take a step back. To have better feelings, practice seeing things differently than you would normally see them. if we see them one way, the only way, be careful. It creates. See, the brain interprets things according to its context that it's understanding it. What is that middle figure? Okay, depends on which way your brain is going. If it goes horizontal, it sees a B. If it goes vertical, it sees a 13. The brain is assessing everything according to its situational context. What is that second letter? It depends on the context. Without the context, we don't know what that slanted figure is. The brain will force a meaning out of nothing. If you put your fingers on the T and the E and blocked it out, and all you saw was a slanted letter with a horizontal, we're not sure what it is. The brain may say it's an A. The brain may say it mostly resembles an H. What I want you to see is our brains are constantly forcing data to make sense of it. This will produce an emotion. It's what our brains do. What do you see in that picture? Pain, screaming. That's good. Do you see straight teeth? Greg Comea, orthodontist. I like it. That was excellent. Now notice what your brain is doing. It's making sense of this, correct? It's trying to come up with an interpretation, right? What is that? Yeah, that's Serena Williams after she just hit a kill shot. So without a broader context, our brain doesn't know what that is, but it says it did because it's forcing it into a prior meaning that makes sense. We wouldn't even question it. We would just say that woman's in pain. I would say, it may seem that way. I don't know. I need more of the story. Make sense? So, an emotion, a feeling, is our brain's best speedy construction, interpretation of sensation and contextual surroundings. Our brain draws from previously learned concepts, forces a meaning, then gives a full-blown emotion. Our brain interprets in relation to what's going on. Did you know the same body sensations, adrenaline pumping, heart racing, dilated pupils, is the same body sensations with a different meaning in a different context? If you're about to go skydiving and jump out of an airplane, heart racing, body pumping blood, adrenaline peeking out, dilated pupils, what does the brain call that? Adventure, excitement, temporary fear, but it's in the context of excitement because you're choosing to go jump out of an airplane. Same body sensations, if you're walking through a parking lot at night in a certain part of town that's unsafe, somebody puts a gun to your head, adrenaline pumping, heart racing, dilated pupils, what's happening there? How does the brain interpret that? Yeah, a crime is about to be committed and you're a victim and you're scared to death. Now, same body sensations. But contextually, the brain is arriving, as it should, with a different meaning of the same body depending on the context. So we should always question and ask ourselves a lot of questions. What am I perceiving? what am I experiencing? So emotions are not necessarily triggered. They're actually, the brain is predicting really rapidly. Be careful of how rapid your brain is making predictions. It's called epistemological humility. How do I know what I think I know right now? Because once you think you know it, your brain is in full-blown emotional state. Be careful. How do you really know what you think you know? How do you know what's in front of you? At least ask a question. Is this accurate? Have you ever interpreted something and you thought you were dead right and you had a full-blown emotional anger or whatever and you came to find out you interpreted it incorrectly and you felt foolish? Of course. Be careful, okay? The more you feel it, the more you will feel it. Okay, now, to the heart of why I'm saying this on the spiritual journey, now that I've laboriously described what the brain does, because you need accurate science. This is not psychobabble. I listed on the class webpage, resource after resource. I put two YouTube videos by Elizabeth, I can't remember her last name right now, How the Brain Makes Emotions. She's world-class, top expert in her field. She has a couple of YouTubes I want you to watch. She has a book that is excellent. I put three chapters from her book. So if you're in doubt of what I'm saying, about the science of what I'm saying, this is not so much psychology as it is medical brain study. I want you to read up on this because this gives us hope that whatever emotions we may be prone to experience, there's hope that we can change those emotions and make them more flexible. We don't have to be a slave to negative emotional states. But it is critical that we understand this because we confuse cause with stimulus. I don't want you to think that the event itself causes what we are experiencing. The events, the stimulus, evoke categories that are already in our brain. It evokes it and reveals what's in us. It didn't cause what's in us. It revealed how I'm prone to see something and react to it. It didn't cause it to be in me. It revealed my past, my present, and how my brain is operating. But human beings, true to human beings, wish to assign blame and causation for everything else out here and deny personal responsibility in here. We're going to see that in just a moment. If we could get out of the notion of you caused me to feel what I'm feeling. You may be a stimulus, but what's inside me and my assessment is actually creating what I'm experiencing. You may have been the trigger, not the cause. Not the cause. So we want to reverse it and say, we can learn a lot about ourselves, the stories we tell ourselves, the propensity of how we see something, why I learned to see something that way, how I'm prone to interpret somebody's responses a certain way and have a certain emotion, tells me more about me than it tells me about you. It tells me about me, first and foremost. The emotions I'm experiencing tell me about me first. That is critical to why I'm teaching the class. We confuse causation with a stimulus. So, feelings are the result of the brain's appraisal of an emotional neurological state that my body is in. This appraisal is influenced by my situation, my past, my present categories in my brain, learned experiences, and even my behaviors. Okay? So stay with me. So what do we do and what do we not do with all this? Now let's get down to just being as practical as I can be. Here's how we tend to use, quote, emotions. When we experience an emotion, our automatic assumption is that something external is the cause. Not the stimulus, the cause. So we say and think what you did or didn't do, or what you said or didn't say, made me feel what I'm feeling. Now we're down to good theology. I'm just sorry. We're also down to good psychology, called cognitive dissonance and self-justifying theory. In theology, it's called depravity. Theology says we have a natural bentness to blame everybody else. Adam and Eve, when God comes to Adam, what's going on and why are you running? What does Adam say? The woman you gave me. I wouldn't be this way. Lord knows. When you catch me when I'm all by myself, I am perfectly fine and mature. But this woman that you gave me has made me a nut job. Ask all my friends. They'll tell you. You were perfectly sane and stable before you met her. Now look what you become. Now when God goes to the woman, he says, how about you? What does she say? You know that serpent that you created that I had a conversation with? It's not my fault. It's that thing over there. So everybody is blame shifting and saying you are the cause of who I am and what I'm experiencing. It's your fault. But naturally, when viewed this way, fault and blame are assigned to the stimulus, not to me and what's inside me. It's out here. It's your fault. I feel this way. So when we do that, we're absolving ourselves of any personal responsibility, and we're blaming the stimulus. It's not me. It's not what's inside me. It's all about you. The emotion that we are experiencing then becomes our self-justifying motivation for whatever happens next, our actions and behaviors. And when people do this, I'm not above this either. They have the perfect defense. The perfect defense is, I feel what I feel. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Nobody would blame me, and it's your fault. You made me feel this way. I would not have put my fist through the wall in our bedroom, except you drove me to it. And I'm going to tell the police that. When they show up, after I call 911, I'm going to absolutely blame you for everything that I'm doing. Okay, I have a right to act the way I'm acting because you made me feel what I'm feeling. ...15-yard penalty flag. So this makes a perfect victim story. And the victim story is the most powerful, well-defended story on the face of the earth. You can't penetrate that. It's your fault I feel this way. I absolve myself of personal responsibility. I'm the victim. You're the perpetrator. I get to act however I want to act because I'm feeling it. Okay. Make sense? So when we create this self-serving, self-justifying story, we exonerate ourselves of any personal responsibility. It's a neat trick. I just don't buy it. Once this happens, I guarantee you, this person's story is not about facts. It's not about truth. It's about a story that's being constructed to absolve self of any personal responsibility. And it's impenetrable to truth. It's impenetrable because the goal is self-justification. The goal is not accuracy. I assure you. This is why I have another principle. I need to create it into a principle. Here it is. Logic cannot displace an idea that was not placed there by logic in the first place. Got that? None of your logic, none of your facts. This is why when people in my office want to condemn and blame the other person and they have powerful emotions for which they're using to accentuate their story, I assure you, it's not about truth, it's not about accuracy. It's about the goal of the story is to blame and convict the other person. So the other person says, I never said that the other night. The other person says, yes, you did. I guarantee you, no matter what the other person says, this person is not going to let go of their story, even if you show them a videotape that says they didn't say that. They're going to say, I heard them say that. Because the goal isn't facts. The goal isn't truth. The goal is a self-justifying motive to convict and blame the other person using emotions and a constructed story to do so. It's a perfect defense. But we've got to reverse that if we're going to be on the spiritual journey. I may experience something. Why would I blame you for it? Unless I want to blame. So once we have thoughts and emotions, here's what happens. Here's the deadly triangle. Once I have a perception, think, thought, interpretation that my brain is assigning a meaning to what I'm currently has happening, then it produces to the right emotions and feelings. Now I'm in a subjective feeling emotional state. Once I have actions, behaviors, the actions and behaviors strengthen the original emotion, which strengthen then my original thinking, which strengthen then the emotions, which strengthen then the behaviors. Do you know the mind and body are so connected that even if you're not feeling an emotion right now, if I got you up and had you act out angry behaviors in your body, acted them out, you'll start feeling anger, the emotion called anger. If I just get your body to start acting angry. This is why the whole catharsis model, catharsis means cleansing in Greek. If you were taught, I got all these emotions bottled up in me. You know what I need to do? So says the colloquial wisdom. I need to vent it and go beat a tree or punch a punching bag to get rid of my anger. Have you ever heard that theory? All psychological data tells us it strengthens the angry emotion. Do you hear that? It doesn't release it and get you in a relaxed state. It jacks you up and prolongs the angry emotion through angry behaviors. Punching! Yelling! It increases the anger feeling through angry emotions and angry behaviors. But everybody says, I just got to get this off my chest. Okay. I don't think you're getting it off your chest. I think it's going in your chest. So what we tell people is, if you're feeling a powerful emotion, I'm not expecting that in that moment you cannot feel it. I'm not questioning the powerful subjective state of an emotion. All I'm going to recommend is try your best not to act it out. It will subside, but the more you act it out through angry or powerful emotional behaviors, you're not dissipating the emotion, you're actually strengthening it. It's going to take long for your body to settle down and get out of an arousal state. Do something else. Try your best not to act the emotion out. Try your best. Try your best. The more you act on the emotion, the more you will rigidify and strengthen the emotion that is giving you a problem. Okay? So then we use our emotions to take front and center stage in our story that we wish to tell. Now, I'm going to say it's one thing to feel a powerful emotion, and I really respect when we feel a powerful emotion. I'm not against emotions. I'm not. I'm pondering what we do with them. I'm going to suggest feel a powerful emotion and ask yourself what's happening in your body and in your brain, and how are you making sense of the situation in front of you. If you want to change something in front of you, if you want to go talk to your boss, and you've had a powerful emotion about unfairness of what's happened at work, first feel the emotion and ask yourself, what's happening? How am I understanding the situation that's making me so upset? If you can look at the data and try to understand, then go into your boss, but don't let your emotions be the lead line in your story. The lead line. Does that make sense? Why would you go into your boss and say, the lead line of my story is, I am really angry, I am totally upset, and I'm mad, and let me tell you why. Okay, that's not the lead line. It is something you're experiencing. Put it second. What's the problem that you're trying to address that may be creating the emotion? Focus on that. Let the angry feeling or the powerful emotion be a drive to something productive. Don't let it take the lead. It may be absolutely legitimate of what's being produced inside of you. Don't take the lead. But all married couples want to sit down. What do they want to lead with? The emotion story. I just don't think it's productive. You can fully feel the emotion, but focus on the data that you want to make changes in. Let the motivation, let the energy of the emotion drive you towards a constructive, productive focus on what you want the problem to be. So, I'm going to say, principle number 6, because I gave you 5, during class 2, principle number 5. This is principle number 6. In order for a problem to have a chance to become the problem in your marriage, significant relationship, or at work, number one goal, don't you become the problem. Now, did you follow that? If alcoholism and overdrinking is an issue in a family, it's a problem. You okay with that? In order for substance abuse and self-medicating behavior to have a chance to actually become the focus that we can focus on and decide what we do with this problem that is existing, this thing, in order to effectively address substance abuse, don't let your response to it take center stage. Because what happens when that happens? What happens to the problem? It recedes, and everybody focuses on your crazy response, emotional response to the problem. So the more you light yourself on fire, douse yourself with gasoline about the problem, what's the problem? The problem or my response to the problem? My response to the problem has now taken center stage. If you go and there's a good attorney and you're asked to sit on a jury, And the defense attorney presents his case before you, the jury, and he or she gets all emotional and jumps up and down and screams, "This guy is innocent," and has a lot of emotions. What do you start focusing on? The case and facts, or the emotional response of the attorney? The emotional response of the attorney. So good attorneys realize, put their personal emotions back here, and as a therapist, I'm putting my emotions back here. I'm fully having my emotions, but I'm not letting my emotions take the lead, so that the issue can become the issue. What do you want to become the issue? The issue. That means you have to have discipline and self-control and manage your emotions so issues can become issue and you and your emotional response don't take center stage as the issue. Because that plays right into the hand of the person who's denying the issue. So when I have an overdrinker and a non-drinker in my office, which one do I have to work with first?
The non-drinker
always. And when I do that, the non-drinker says, "Why are you talking to me? I'm not the one that's got the problem. They got the problem." I turn to the one who's over-drinking and I say, "Do you think you have a problem?" They say, "Yes." There's my problem. To which now the non-drinker comes unglued and says, "I do not have the problem." And the non-drinker goes on for 30 minutes complaining about the drinker, while the drinker sits there and goes, "See what I'm talking about? See what I live with? If I did have a drinking problem, now you know why I have a drinking problem. I'm not saying I do, but if I did..." So now the person without the problem has become the problem in their emotional response to the problem. You get it? This is why, if we can effectively manage how we see things, we can make the issue, and the problem, and you have to say, before you lead out in a discussion about an important issue in your relationship, ask yourself, what do you want the focus to be? The issue? Or you and your emotional upsetness to the issue? Ask yourself that. Because if you don't care, then go ahead and light yourself on fire. Because you want to. But now what's happened to the issue? It's gone. Now the person is saying, "I may have a problem. Oh my gosh. But you're a bigger problem." Okay, principle 6, principle 7. Principle 7, we are each responsible for our response to the problem. No matter what happens, no matter how we are treated, no matter how much we are wronged, our character and our values still tell us we are each responsible for our response. If somebody hits us, we are still responsible for our response. I didn't say that was easy. I said, I can never fully blame another human being. I'm still responsible for my response. I'm still responsible. There's the problem, and there's our response to the problem. You know, if we have to respond huge with huge emotions to get people to change, you better get used to it, because you're going to have to respond bigger the next time. Do you know, when I ask people why they're yelling at their spouse or significant other or child, what do they usually say? Why?
Listen.
That's right. They won't hear me. I can't
it's
break.
True.
Yes. There's some truth, but the problem is it's a law of diminishing return. If I have to get loud because they wouldn't hear me with a normal voice, something more is going on. and then they hear me, you'll have to get louder the next time. Then you'll have to get louder. And you're morphing into a caricature of yourself. All the while the other person is realizing they're in control. They're making you into a crazy person. So I says, if our emotional response does not bring about the change we want, well, even if it does, I think it's short-lived, and now we got to keep doing that. Okay, lastly. I would want you to take this particular slide and try to work it this week. Anytime you have an emotion, a powerful or a mild emotion, work this worksheet. Ask yourself, observe and describe the event that you think prompted the emotion, the trigger. Somebody cut you off. Somebody walked in a room, didn't make eye contact, and you thought, you think you're better than me. You snubbed me. Makes me really angry. Just try to write down the event and describe it. Then number two, try to identify your brain's interpretation, the story. How is your brain assessing, interpreting, making sense that then created the emotion, the interpretation? Now, in my office and in my notes, we are trained to not overly interpret. I do not write in my notes, client's a jerk. That's an interpretation. I do not write in my notes, clearly diagnosable narcissistic. That's a label. It's an interpretation. What I do is describe behaviors. Client appeared upset, had some emotions. Client got up, said, I'm done with this, to their spouse, slammed the door and left my office. Client came back 10 minutes later. I'm describing using neutral terms. Be careful about interpretation terms. Interpretation. Somebody says, I'm going to have a tough time this Thanksgiving and Christmas. Why? My mother is coming. It's difficult when she's here. Right when she walks in, she starts rearranging the furniture. She takes over. She's controlling. She tells me about this. I'm never good enough. I said, how about this? Instead of the interpretation word with a personal pronoun, my mother. What's her first name? Betty. Would you please say, Betty is coming to visit me? The change of those two words just alleviated some of the emotion of my mother. It's too personal. It implies so many connections. What if she's a separate human being, an elderly woman called Betty? What if Betty has a neurosis and has just been released from a inpatient psychiatric unit? Her name is Betty. She's going to come have dinner with you. She's not your mother. She's Betty. Even achieving neutrality and separateness through language helped my client not feel all the negative emotions. I just neutralized it by being more clinical. I say sometimes to my clients, pretend you're a clinical psychologist. Pretend you're a teacher at a school. You cannot grab your child's arm and jerk them around and threaten them. You'll be fired. Pretend you work for customer service and people come up and complain to you. It's your job to be clinical, objective, you're getting paid, and to not take this personally. They're just a guest visiting you. It can alleviate a lot of personal emotions by retelling the story. Then observe and describe the actual experience and the physical sensations in your body. Be clinical. Client got up, walked out of the room. Versus, client thought I was a bad therapist and hated my guts. How dare them? That's going to create a lot of emotions in me because it's an interpretation. Be clinical. Observe and describe any behaviors you had after that. I got up, I was so mad, and I slammed the door. Okay, I bet that created a lot of emotion. And describe the after effects in your life. Okay, lastly, stay with me. And your identity and your emotions are not the same thing. You are not your emotions. You have emotions. You are not your emotions. And that's helpful. You are Mary. You are Sally. You are Billy. You're a Tom who has emotions. That makes all the difference in the world. You and your emotions and your identity are not the same thing. Okay? And remember, people usually share emotions to influence and change everybody else. Lastly, be careful if you share your emotions with somebody else. Be careful of your motive. Why are you sharing it? What is the purpose of your sharing? When is it right? Ask yourself, if you express your emotions to a person you love and care about, ask yourself, what do you want to happen as a result? At least ask yourself that question before you automatically share. And ask yourself, what change do you want to see happen? Please be careful, don't let your emotions take center stage. The change you want to happen takes center stage. Your emotions are important. Be careful, they could get way out front and people can't hear what you're trying to say. Make sense? Thank you. You've been so patient. I know it's a lot of technical data. Please, please, read on the website. I have so many chapters and things for you to look at. Don't feel overwhelmed, but they're invaluable. When we can change how we see things, we change how we feel. And we have greater emotional control, and we feel freer. We don't feel a slave. We can have our emotions without our emotions having us. Okay? See you next week.